A minister decided that a visual demonstration would add emphasis to his Lent course on abstention. So at the beginning of his sermon, he put around on the pulpit four lidded jars. And in each jar was a worm, a living worm. In the first jar, there was also some alcohol. In the second jar, there was some cigarette smoke. And the third jar, there was some chocolate syrup. And in the fourth jar, there was some good, clean, wholesome earth. At the end of the sermon, he took each jar and held them up. The jar that had alcohol in it, the worm was dead. The jar that had had the cigarette smoke in it, the worm was dead. The jar that had the chocolate syrup in it, the worm was dead. Just the jar with the good wholesome earth in it had a still living, wriggling worm. The minister asked the congregation, "What did you learn from that demonstration?" As quick as a flash, Paula raised her hand and said, "As long as you drink, smoke and eat chocolate, you won't have worms." Right. Okay. In our talks thus far, we've seen that the first catastrophic effect of the fall was that as Adam and Eve disobeyed God and obeyed Satan, there was an immediate breakdown in relationships, both with God and between Adam and Eve. This is seen in that we're told in Genesis 3 that it was in the cool of the day that God searched for them, indicating that what he'd originally planned was a relaxed, open and intimate relationship with humankind. But we also see in that creation story that the Lord intended us to have relationships between us. He says in Genesis 2:18, "It is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper suitable for him." And tonight, in the fourth of our talks, Relationships Transformed, I want to look at how damaged and broken relationships are transformed, healed, restored through the cross. The vertical relationship with God and the horizontal relationship with each other. And I'm sure you've all heard that or seen that illustration of how the sign of the cross reminds us both of the vertical and the horizontal relationships. So we begin with our relationship with God. Of course, much of this was explored last week when we saw that we're no longer sinners cowering in fear of punishment, fear of being clobbered by God for the simplest of mistakes. But we're now saints, seated with Christ in the heavenly realms. We're no longer orphans, feeling abandoned in a hostile universe, but adopted as children of God, heirs and co-heirs with Christ, as Paul puts it in Romans 8. Moreover, as Bill Johnson calls the greatest promotion in history, Jesus told his disciples, I no longer call you servants, because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends, for everything that I learned from my Father, I have made known to you. We now have a relationship with God based on grace, not law. What we now do for God, we do out of love, not because we ought to or else. A beautiful illustration of this I read in the Church of England newspaper about 3 years ago. A little story. I don't know actually whether it's true or whether it's an allegory, but allow me to read it to you. A husband and wife didn't really love each other. The man was very demanding, so much so that he prepared a list of rules and regulations for his wife to follow. He insisted that she read them over every day and obeyed them to the letter. Among other things, his do's and don'ts indicated such details as what time she had to get up in the morning, when his breakfast should be served, and how the housework should be done. After several long years, the husband died. As time passed, the woman fell in love with another man, one who dearly loved her. Soon they were married. This husband did everything he could to make his wife happy, continually showering her with tokens of his appreciation. One day, as she was cleaning the house, she found tucked away in a drawer the list of commands her first husband had drawn up for her. As she looked it over, it dawned on her that even though her present husband hadn't given her any kind of list, she was doing everything her first husband's list required anyway. She realized she was so devoted to this man that her deepest desire was to please him out of love, not out of obligation. I love that illustration of the change that our relationship with God should experience. And of course, because of the amazing gift of the Spirit poured out as a result of the finished work on the cross, along with the resurrection and ascension, our relationship with God can be freely two-way. He can speak to us, and we can speak to him. Prayer is no longer a religious duty or obligation, nor a shopping list monologue, but rather a conversation. Moreover, like any healthy relationship, ours with God is meant to grow and develop and expand and deepen as we discover more of his love and his character, and we are open to fresh revelation from him. As Pete Carter at Eastgate is frequently heard to say, God is infinite, so we will never ever run out of discovering new things about him. But before we move on to the horizontal relationships between us, which is the main focus, I want to remind you that our relationship with God is meant to be truly open and intimate. And if it's going to be that, we have an important part to play. Near the end of the Sermon on the Mount, there are some very disturbing words of Jesus. "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, 'Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, and in your name drive out demons and perform many miracles?' Then I will tell them plainly, 'I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers.'" That's a pretty scary thing on the lips of the so-called meek and mild Jesus. But what's the point? I believe that the point is this. It's the difference between knowing about somebody and knowing somebody. You see, knowing about somebody has never been easier. Google. But to actually know somebody requires that they open up themselves to us. And remember, God will never violate our free will. He, of course, knows everything about us. But for him to actually know us requires our permission. See, these folks that Jesus was talking about were, in a sense, doing all the right thing. But they'd never let Jesus into their lives. Hence, he never knew them. We see this, I believe, quite clearly in what is one of my all-time favourite psalms, Psalm 139. David begins by saying, "O Lord, you have searched me and know me." The word there is "know about me." "You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my coming in. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you know it completely." David recognized that God, being God, knew everything about him. But at the end of the psalm, he invites God not just to know about him, but to know him. "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts." I guess we all want to know more of God, but do we know that he wants to know us more intimately? And it is utterly amazing to me that the all-powerful, infinite creator of the universe allows himself to be limited in his relationship with us to what we allow. Okay, let's move on to the horizontal. Of course, I need hardly remind you that our relationship with each other is inextricably linked with our relationship with God. You can't really separate them. John points this out in his first letter, 1 John 4:19 to 21. "We love," why? "Because he first loved us. If anyone says, 'I love God,' and yet hates his brother, he is a liar. For anyone who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. And he has given us this command: whoever loves God must also love his brother. So I want to take as my starting point of us loving each other the amazing new command that Jesus gave in the upper room on that fateful Thursday evening before his arrest. A new command I give you: love one another. As I have loved you, so must you love one another. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. For many a year, I used to wonder why that was a new command: love one another. Had we not read in the New Testament on a few occasions that the second of the great commandments was to love your neighbour as yourself? Leviticus 19:18, and quoted in the Gospels such as Mark 12:31. But the new command is not to love one another. It's this bit: as I have loved you, so must you love one another. Wow. If we stop and think about that: as I have loved you, Jesus said, so you must love one another. This is why it's a new command. You see, under the old covenant, that quoted from Leviticus, the standard of us loving another was ourselves. Love your neighbor as yourself. I'll leave aside the famous debate that was asked, "Who is my neighbor?" by the expert in the law who wanted to justify himself, and led to one of Jesus' most famous parables, that of the Good Samaritan. But you see, what's really new about this command of Jesus is that the standard is no longer you and me, but him. We're no longer looking to ourselves as to how we love someone else, but we're looking to Jesus. That's amazing on many fronts. But let me just look at two in particular. You see, in the natural, how we love is very often heavily dependent on our upbringing, how we were loved or not as children. Was the love we receive from our parents conditional or unconditional? Well, was it remote or was it intimate? Was it critical or affirming? I guess for all of us, it would be a mixture, because none of us had perfect parents any more than those of us sitting here this evening who are parents are perfect. So in the natural, how we love others is quite greatly influenced by how we have been loved by others. But there's another important reality. Very sadly, in our society today, there are many who don't actually love themselves. So when the old law says, love your neighbour as yourself, if you don't love yourself very much, that's not too helpful. The seemingly ever-increasing suicide rates in this country point to that. Most drink and drug problems are related to people who don't really love themselves. And then there's the vast numbers of people who suffer from various mental health problems. And I want to say straight away, I'm not saying that all mental health problems are due to a lack of self-love. Of course, there are chemical and physical reasons. But the fact remains that much mental health problem is down to self-hatred or loathing. Thus, to love yourself, love your neighbour as yourself, can be a pretty poor benchmark. And hence, in this new command of Jesus, he not only ups the stakes, but he gives us the perfect benchmark, himself. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. Before I move on, note that that new command comes with a wonderful promise. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. This actually provides a link with my final talk next week, Communities Transformed. But before I look at the practical outworkings of loving one another, I want to ask the question, what does as I have loved you look like? The answer, of course, is to read the Gospels, to see how Jesus loved everybody, irrespective of their station in life. However, in view of the focus on the cross, let me quote you from Jesus on that same Thursday evening. My command is this, love each other as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. Now clearly, in the context of where Jesus was speaking, laying down his life had particular relevance to the cross. But I believe it meant more than that unique event. I believe it includes every time we put others first. Every time we go the extra mile, not grudgingly, but happily. Every time, like that wife in that story I read near the beginning, every time that she did something for her husband simply because she loved him. I think all of that encompasses what Jesus meant when he said that he who lays down his life for his friends expresses the greatest love. I think if I was sitting where you're sitting and listening to an old man prattling on about love, I'd be thinking, well, it's all very well, all this talk about love and helping each other and all that. But what does it look like in practice? How do I love that irritating person who always seems to sit behind me on Sunday in church and fidgets all the way through the service? I can see that that resonates with a lot of you. How do you love them? How do you love those people who are so different from us that somehow, as hard as we try, they somehow rub up against us? Well, first and foremost, we need to remember what Jesus said, love as I have loved you. We need to have our thinking transformed by the renewing of our minds, as we've already talked about. We need to remember and keep reminding ourselves that Jesus loves and died for even that irritating fidget behind us in church. Because each and every one of us is made in the image and likeness of God. But also, in a sense, when we get irritated by somebody else's behavior, we need to recognize that that's not meaning that we hate them. It's not the same as not loving them. Jesus, in fact, quite often got irritated by people, by the disciples, how slow they were, how they lacked faith, how they bickered who was the greatest. But he never stopped loving them. And in loving and gentle and appropriate ways, he would rebuke them. And he was willing to do so over and over. But second, there are some really practical ways in many of Paul's letters. You will probably know that generally Paul's letters are in two halves. The first half is a statement of where we are, who we are, what God has done for us. And the second half is kind of the practical outworking of that, how we live and behave, how our relationships are related to our identity. A favorite example of mine is in the third chapter of Colossians. And I'd like to read it to you before we look at it in some detail. Chapter 3 of Colossians. Since then you have been raised with Christ, set your hearts on things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things above, not on earthly things, for you died, and your life is now hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. It goes on to talk about some negative things. Put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature: sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires and greed, which is idolatry. Because of these, the wrath of God is coming. You used to walk in these ways in the life you once lived, but now you must rid yourselves of all such things as these: anger, rage, malice, slander, and filthy language from your lips. Do not lie to each other, since you have taken off your old self with its practices and have put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge in the image of its creator. Here there is no Greek or Jew, circumcised or uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave or free, but Christ is all and is in all. Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness and patience. Bear with each other and forgive whatever grievances you may have against one another. Forgive as the Lord forgave you. And over all these virtues, put on love, which binds them all together in perfect unity. Let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, since as members of one body you were called to peace. And be thankful. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly as you teach and admonish one another with all wisdom, and as you sing psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs with gratitude in your hearts to God. And whatever you do, whether in word or deed, do it all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him. I want to focus this evening, if I might, on just verses 12 to 14. Some years ago, in fact in 1999, to be precise, the year that I was ordained, we were leaving the church where we had been a member during my training, and Jenny had a vision for these 12 to 14 verses of Colossians 3. And together with a sort of arty friend of ours, she designed this wonderful banner and made it. And I want to look briefly now at each attribute, and then as part of our group discussion in a few minutes, you can explore them further. But please note the context, the opening lines of what Paul says in verse 1 of chapter 3. Since then you have been raised with Christ. All that we were talking about last week, it comes out of who we are. The list begins with compassion. You will know that compassion was the commonest driving force for Jesus. Moved with compassion, he fed the 5,000. Or healed here, there, and everywhere. Compassion for us is meaning that we feel for another person. We feel with another person. Compassion is how love listens. Listens to words spoken and not spoken by another. And then there's kindness. In lots of ways, kindness seems to have gone out of fashion because it sounds almost too ordinary. Yet the most exalted love needs to find expression in simple, practical help. A word of encouragement can have enormous power, but also the help of practical kindness for and from others is needed by all of us from time to time. Love looks and notices as well as listens. Love is kindness, everyday kindness. And then there's humility. What does that mean in a relationship? It certainly doesn't mean saying, I'm no good at anything. Humility is about putting others first. It's actually about having a genuine assessment of our abilities and gifts. Humility accepts genuine praise from others. I remember when I was a vicar in my church in Chatham. It took me a very long time to get one of our very gifted worship leaders to accept that when she had led a good morning's worship very skillfully, and I thanked her, to stop saying, oh, it's nothing to do with me, it was all about him. It took a long time for me to tell her, no, it's about you both. You played your important part. Love seeks the best for others. Love is humble. And then there's gentleness. Again, gentleness can somehow be a kind of wimpy sort of thing. It's not that. It's the opposite of harshness. Jesus said, I am gentle and humble in heart. We'll never want to be harsh with others, even if there's been, in our view, a grievous failure. Love loathes a harsh spirit. Love is gentle. And then there's patience. Sometimes we think we know others quite well, but as we get to know them better, all kinds of surprising traits and characteristics will emerge as our relationships grow. Most of these will just be differences in the way that we do things or we've been brought up. St. Francis says, where there is patience and humility, there is neither anger nor vexation. So we need to put on the garment of patience with each other. We mustn't try to make others in our image. Love is long-suffering. Love is patient. And then there's forgiveness. Well, one could spend a whole year preaching on that one word. But I guess many of us know that there are times when we don't find it easy to forgive when we have a grievance against someone. But this is an item of clothing to be worn in sunshine and in the rain. It's forgiveness. Love lets go of grievances. John Wesley said, love does not yield to provocation. It triumphs over all. Jesus forgave every foolish, every mean, every unpleasant thing we ever did when he died on the cross. So let us be quick to forgive so that bitterness has no root. Love is always quick to forgive. And here's the last, love itself. You see on the banner that it's at the top. All the others hang from it. And over all these virtues, Paul says, put on love, which binds them all together in perfect unity. This is the love that means self-giving surrender to others. It sounds alarming. It sounds dangerous. It's risky, but it turns out to be amazingly joyous and comfortable. And ultimately, it will be the cement, the glue, that brings us together in the unity. It will be that love by which others will know we are Jesus' disciples. And all this is made possible by the cross. As we remembered last week, we're not alone in this. We're not meant to struggle under our own strength. As we look to Jesus, as we allow the Spirit to work in and through us, we and thereby our relationships, first with God and then with each other, will be transformed. A new command I give you, said Jesus. Love one another as I have loved you. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. Sadly, the church for too long has been known for what divides. And I don't mean the great big divisions between Catholic and Protestant. I mean divisions within local churches. But by God's amazing grace, if we will let him, let us be those who are known for our love for one another. In our groups tonight, could you distribute those around, please? Thank you. In our groups tonight, I've suggested two or three things to do. Do as much or as little as you like. But the first thing is, in the light of knowing who we are in Christ, discuss any difference between doing something because we ought to, or else, and doing something out of love. And now I've got the scary one. The second one is scary, but have a go at it. If you feel able, if you feel you can, go round your group telling the person on your right something you love about them. And then finally, children, I wasn't a school teacher for 26 years. I haven't given you permission to talk. Finally, we're going to leave the banner up, and you might just like to share some experiences you've had of when you've been on the receiving end of any of those.